Hello and welcome back to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined by my co-host from the IEA, Chris Snowden. How are you doing, Chris?
I'm not too bad, thanks, Tom. Thanks for asking. And of course, hello, listeners.
Absolutely. And also a big hello, a big welcome back to the show to Rob Lyons from the Academy of Ideas. How are you doing, Rob?
Very well, Tom. Thank you very much.
So let's kick things off, Chris, with one of the stories that you've picked out, which is about some of Tony Blair's ideas for the health service. I know you also want to talk about physicians associates, but let's focus on Blair for the minute, because he's reading the room in brilliant style, suggesting that if anything, we've got too many GPs, and that the answer to the issue of primary care in particular is to make more and more people go through fewer and fewer services, and also for AI and chatbots to pick up some of the slack. Chris, do you want to tell us a bit more about this particular unpublished but leaked report that has been doing the rounds a bit?
Yeah, so Tony Blair has been suggesting that we use a lot more AI in healthcare, and I haven't looked into his proposal in any length, but the important point is this should mean doctors being made redundant. And my long-term plan for the NHS is to have every senior doctor and GP sacked and working in my salt mines and picking fruit. Which is where I believe they belong, and that might wipe the arrogant smirk off their faces. Now, this is not necessarily a popular idea with the British Medical Association, but anything that moves us a bit further towards that point, I think, is a good thing. In my opinion, GPs are only they're only chatbots anyway, a lot of the time. diagnosing something is clearly something a computer can do, because you're just literally just crossing things out by process elimination. Ideal for a robot. If Tony Blair hasn't called this thing ChatGP, then he's missed a trick, I think.
Yep.
As I say, didn't bother looking into details, just like winding up doctors with this kind of thing. Obviously, the doctors hated the idea. They immediately started going on about one of the people who donates money to the Tony Blair Institute, who has got something to do with AI. They probably started saying that this guy wants to privatise the NHS. That's usually what they say. And that the data isn't safe in his hands. Tony Blair is kind of obsessed with collecting data. But to be fair, in the health service, I don't think that is a bad thing. I don't think there's very much joined up thinking when it comes to, you know, there's no bloody continuity of care anymore. So computers can help at least remember who you are and what's wrong with you. I don't think that would be a bad thing. Doctors are, they hate it. Because any attempt to lighten their load, they see as a threat, fundamentally. They'll always say, oh, we're overworked, we're just doing too much low-level stuff. But if someone comes in with an idea like this, or indeed physicians associates, which we'll come on to, they kick their feet and talk about, oh, the NHS has been privatised. And essentially they see quite rightly that this is a threat to their job prospects and incomes in the long term.
And Rob, just to kick it to you for a second. Well, in pursuit of the contrary view, I suppose, can you not understand why people might be concerned about this plan? Not least because people are really feeling that they're not getting the kind of care that they want at the moment anyway. And on top of that, what Blair is talking about reportedly is going from primary care networks looking after like 30 to 50,000 people to actually they should look after about 250,000 each. So you can understand why people would be concerned about this. Surely a chatbot can't fill the gap in the way that Chris is suggesting.
Well, I mean, my recent experiences of chatbots, and certainly that is the case. Although the image in my head that I got when Chris was talking was of primary care centres being replaced with lots of medical self-checkouts, where you would just go in, scan the chip that they've embedded into your arm, and then just type in your symptoms like you're choosing baked goods supermarket checkout. I mean, I think that AI at the moment is nowhere near good enough to sort of process what people need from a medical diagnosis. But they could be used by someone with a modicum of training to talk to you and actually come up with better diagnoses or to point you in the right direction for things. I mean, essentially, at this point in time, seeing anybody or indeed anything in the NHS would be a step forward. I've lived in leaving here in Fife for 3 years, and I don't think I've managed to see a GP. I've barely seen a dentist. So anything that would be a step forward. Probably the physician's associates idea, or having non-GPs see you in primary care, is probably more of a goer at the moment, and there are many advantages to it. But maybe I'm getting ahead of myself.
And Chris, unless there's anything more you want to say on ChatGP, as you've memorably dubbed it?
Well, all I would say is that it's very common for GPs and doctors in general to literally Google your symptoms now. So the idea that we can't teach some sort of AI program to do exactly the same thing, I think, is a bit far-fetched. And the bloody 111 service, or whatever it's called, I mean, which is, again, supposed to lighten the load, is completely useless because they just have a go at Googling it, but they're not confident enough to make a diagnosis, so they say go see your GP. We could close that down quite happily and replace GPs with walk-in centres. You know, I like the idea of having a family doctor. In an ideal world, you'd have a family doctor who sees you and your family for decades and then passes it on to another doctor, and you get continuity of care. But unfortunately, GPs have decided they don't want to provide that. Most GPs work part-time. Huge number of GPs are locums. So you don't have a family doctor anymore. You don't have continuity of care, certainly where I live and I think where most people live. So if we're not going to have that, then what's the point of having a GP? You might as well just have a walk-in centre, because you're going to see somebody different every time anyway. So get rid of the GPs, let's have a walk-in centre. And yeah, a lot of it can be self-service checkout, as far as I'm concerned. If you just want to get some, you know, a repeat prescription or something, go for it.
Increasingly dystopian vision. Should we talk about physicians' associates a bit more, unless there's anything more that you want to add there, Rob? Just because Rob just referenced it, and I also know that you've written something for The Critic recently, Chris, about the kind of campaign against these physicians' associates. You want to explain what they are and also why there's so much hostility to their existence from the existing kind of medical establishment?
Yes. I'd never heard of it, I think, until about a year ago. I don't think probably most people have. They've been working in the NHS since 2003, totally without any kind of controversy. There's not actually that many of them. There's only about 4,000 physician associates in the NHS, as opposed to about 190,000 doctors, and total NHS workforce of, I think, 1.3 million people now. Terribly understaffed, the NHS. So they were just brought in just as one of many auxiliary staff, you know, no different to independent nurse prescribers, which I think were briefly controversial. Not really different to nurses, to be quite honest with you. You know, I mean, there are people just who are differently qualified in the NHS. It's horses for courses. You have associate anaesthetists as well, Yeah, point is, you have auxiliary staff. It's horses for courses. Not everybody needs to be a fully trained doctor to deal with people who come through the door, obviously. And the less qualified they are, the less they get paid. Therefore, the more affordable they are. You can afford three PAs for physician associates for one locum GP, certainly. And there's been a bit of a furore about them, whipped up entirely by the doctors, and particularly the hardline doctors who now run the British Medical Association. So there's a takeover of the BMA to 2022, kind of a Corbynite, you know, entryism from a group called itself the Doctors' Votes. And they initially got their people on the board by saying, we're going to stiffen the BMA's resolve with regards to the strikes. But they are also really gunning for physician associates because they see them as a threat, again, like the AI, to their privilege and status and income. And so even though there's not many of these people working in the NHS, the plan is to expand it, the role a bit, and expand other roles. And they're not just after the PAs. They want to gun for all these other, what they consider to be kind of low-level, you know, less qualified people, in order that the government employs more consultants, more GPs, and more junior doctors. This is not good for the general public, who just want to see somebody and are quite happy to see somebody like a PA. My daughter to a PA the other day, fairly minor thing, no problem at all, exactly the kind of thing that PAs should be there for. There has been a couple of legitimate concerns with regards to, you know, the concern that people may be mistaking PAs for doctors, or that PAs are kind of masquerading as doctors. That's the kind of stuff you can just sort out with general regulation. That's not what the BMA are after. The BMA want to get rid of these people completely. They've called for a halt to all PA recruitment. PAs are already being bullied, literally bullied out of their jobs. It's been an unbelievably vicious campaign. Like a lot of kind of weird subcultures on Twitter, you don't realize it exists until you poke it one day. And I poked it the other day, a few months ago. And just got a whole, you know, like 5 days of constant attacks. I've written this piece for The Critic, knowing full well it would revive these people. And yeah, I don't care, because I quite enjoy being the subject of a Twitch hunt. It's good fun. But, you know, not everybody does enjoy it. And so a lot of people keep their head down on this particular issue. But yeah, no, these people are scum, a lot of them. They really are the most vicious, horrible people, posting under anonymous names, claiming to be doctors. I assume they are doctors. A lot of them set up another account, pretend to be patients. Say, you know, it's not just doctors concerned about this. I'm a patient. I think they should be bad. It's like, wow, yeah, okay, you're just an ordinary patient. And every single thing you ever tweeted about is about physician associates. You know? So yeah, mad campaign against these people. I like to stick up for the underdog. So I stood up for them and pointed out what this is really about, which is, in particular in GP surgeries, you've got locum GPs who for a long time were getting away with getting paid £15,000 per month and thought they could carry on this grift forever because the health service is always short-staffed. And then a few GP surgeries, mainly in rural areas where they couldn't attract locum doctors, they decided to start using more in the way of people like physician associates to help lighten the load because they literally couldn't afford to be paying locum doctors what locum doctors thought they were worth. And so locum doctors went whining to The Guardian a few months ago saying, oh, loads of us can't find a job. You know, 80% of out of work, locum doctors can't find work. Rather than drop their wage demands, which is what you would normally do in a market, they have decided to nobble the competition. It's disgraceful, really.
And what do you think, Rob? Do you share Chris's huge sympathy for these PAs and his white-hot, borderline obsessive hatred for GPs in this particular?
I'm not sure I share the borderline, dysfunctional, whatever, hatred for GPs, but it seems to make perfect sense that we should be taking the load off them as much as possible. So the government has already made a big deal about go to your pharmacist for initial medical consultation. And basically, most of us want to go to somebody who has some idea about medicine and say, what is this? How do I get it fixed? So I had an issue a few months ago. I got on a train to Dundee, slightly bashed myself on the journey and decided to do something very stupid, which is kick the train. And therefore, nearly breaking my toe, badly bruising it. And then about 3 months later, my big toe started to fall off. And I just needed a medical professional to look at that and go, is it all right? I mean, what do I do? It's pretty minor stuff. Eventually, I had to email somebody from podiatry in my local health service. And they said, don't do anything, trim it a bit. It'll be fine. And there's just so much of what the health service needs to do or would really help people is just dealing with that quite minor stuff. And if it's a physician associate, whether it's a advanced nursing practitioner, which is another popular not doctor first port of call. So there's a surgery in London, which has no GPs at all. It has three advanced nursing practitioners. And apparently it's very successful and very popular because people get seen much more quickly than if they had to wait on a GP. So I think that's the role of a GP, fundamentally to be a gateway. It's either there's nothing wrong with you or it'll clear up. Here's a prescription for it, or I have to send you off to a consultant. That's what GPs do. So why not get somebody else who's just trained specifically in that job of triaging people and save the health service an awful lot of money in the process?
And still having that face-to-face content, I suppose, Chris, because not everything can be provided by the chatbot.
Well, no, because... Well, I think, you know, you listen to what Rob says there. He's obviously quite right. You know, either they give you antibiotics or they tell you there's nothing wrong, it'll get better on its own. Or they send you to a specialist. Let's see why a computer could do that 90% of the time. Anyway, let's not, you know, if in the meantime, while we're still testing this technology out, let's at least give people like physician associates a go. And when I said this, I've been accused. I mean, they're so one-dimensional, these people. They go, oh, well, you're at the IEA, you just want to privatize the health service. That's why you're in favor of physician associates. Like, can anyone explain the logic there? Like, what is the connection between physician associates working in GP surgeries, which are already private? What has this got to do with private? Nothing.
So it's just... They'd outsource it to... G4S would have the contract or something to provide all these physician associates.
Well, it doesn't... None of it makes any sense. It's just a yelp. It's just a knee-jerk. It's what they say to anything that, you know... Because they never get the public going. You say to the stupid, bovine British public, oh, these guys want to privatise the NHS, they will get on board straight away. And so this physician-associate issue, which is pretty niche in the great scheme of things, has attracted the likes of, you know, Carol Vorderman and James O'Brien because they appeal to this lowest common denominator of they want to privatise the NHS. And also, this is a patient safety issue as well. Right? This is what the public sector always say when they're after more money. It's about safety. It's like when the bloody so-called guards went on strike on Southern Rail years ago. It was obviously about money. But no, it's not. It's about going to be passenger safety. Of course it wasn't. As soon as they gave them some more money, they shut up and went back to work. So they weaponized the death, this very sad death of somebody who was wrongly diagnosed by a PA and turned out to have a blood clot, which he then died of, completely ignoring the fact that exactly the same thing happened with a GP up in Scotland only this year. And indeed, pretty much every week, if you look for stories in the papers of doctors misdiagnosing people and that resulting in terrible outcomes, you can do it. No one's going to say, let's sack all GPs because GPs made a misdiagnosis. People make mistakes, especially in the NHS. But to sort of cherry pick this one case and put it all over the news, which they have done for over a year now, every time PAs are mentioned, this poor woman is caught up in it. It's just, it's pretty low stuff, I think, this whole campaign.
And surely the biggest issue in terms of patient safety is an inability to access any kind of health professional whatsoever. That and the crucial importance of guards on trains, of course. But Rob, unless there's any more on that, should we turn to one of the stories that you've picked out to talk about today, which I must say I wasn't aware of. And when I read the headline, at least, I was pretty surprised to find out that a new report has suggested that alcohol consumption in Ireland has fallen by nearly a third since 2001. Do you want to tell us a bit about this and whether or not those numbers are quite all they seem?
Well, I mean, yes. Yeah, so obviously Ireland is famous for its pub culture. And growing up, I spent many a holiday in Ireland with the family and got taught how to drink beer in Ireland. And so it was always a sort of a centrepiece of Irish society was the pub. And that would seem to be in decline, according to these figures, which suggest that alcohol consumption has dropped by 31% since 2001. And I think that is possibly quite plausible, actually, because of the pressures that have been faced by the Irish drinker. First of all, the smoking ban in 2003, meaning that the Irish pub was not anything like its old hospitable self. The sheer price of alcohol anyway, so Dublin somehow manages to be even more expensive than London for drinking, and London is eye-watering enough. But then in 2 years ago, they introduced minimum unit pricing to make drinking at home more expensive. And I thought Scotland was bad, but then I looked at what the minimum unit price is in Ireland, and it's €1 per unit, which is about 84 pence at current exchange rates. Which makes...
They do have very slightly larger units in Ireland, it should be said. But you're still a lot more than what it is in Scotland.
Exactly. I mean, and that's even after Scotland's price rises to 65p in September this year. So the Irish drinker has been right on the thick end of it for quite some time in terms of just being able to enjoy a drink. And so it's no wonder that there's been some moderation of drinking habits just because it's more expensive. But whether that's actually had any effect on the sort of dangerous drinkers, I'm less sort of sanguine about. As we saw in Scotland, that actually minimum unit pricing has had very little effect on people's health in terms of liver cirrhosis and all that sort of stuff with drinkers up here. So, but yes, I can well imagine that the sociability of Ireland has been reduced somewhat considerably by the decline of drinking.
Well, this is what success looks like if you're in public health, isn't it? Lots of pubs closing down and people unable to afford to drink as much as they would like to. I believe, to be fair, Rob, that alcohol deaths have fallen in this century, at least in Ireland, from a fairly high base. I mean, to what extent this is actually the result of policy is always difficult to say. I mean, it would make sense that something like €1 floor price on the unit of alcohol has had an effect. But that's only been in place for 3 years or so, during which there hasn't been a decline in alcohol-related deaths. So I don't know if it's been a decline in consumption. Minimum pricing is a remarkably ineffective measure at the best of times. And, of course, there has been a big drop in drinking in Britain. From about 2003 until the middle of the last decade, there was a quite significant, getting off a 20% decline. And per capita consumption, which didn't seem to have anything to do with any policies because there weren't any policies It was just changing tastes, and regular readers will know how much I dislike young people as well as doctors. They're not drinking sufficiently, are they? In London, when it comes to pubs, you can't blame them. You know, we're now regularly looking at over £7 a pint now in London. It's absolutely bonkers. But not everyone lives in London, and plenty of people have access to Wetherspoons, so it's no real excuse. But yeah, for various reasons, people are drinking less, and if that's what they want to do, that's fine with me, I guess. Well, it's not really, but in theory, it's fine with me. My principles say it should be fine with me, and therefore it is. But if it's not because they've chosen to, it's because they've been priced out of the market or the local pub has closed down, then it's not a good thing, whatever people in public health may believe.
And Rob, just picking up on Chris's point there about what a depressing trend this is, I suppose. Is there an argument that the part of this is sort of cultural as well, that for whatever reason, it's not just the fact that a pint in certain places has crept over the £7 mark, certainly in London. It's also the fact that maybe younger generations, or just that kind of the sort of more convivial pub life of previous generations has sort of evaporated a bit.
Yeah, I think that is true. And I think that part of that is, well, certainly in Ireland, because I've seen Ireland become much, much wealthier over the past 40 years when, going to stay with my cousins and then burning peat in the fireplace to, everybody having technology jobs or whatever, then, Ireland is a very different place. And there's just other stuff you could be doing rather than just going to your local every evening and drinking because there's only two channels on the TV. So in some ways, that's progress that, they've got more options in terms of what you do with your time than just simply going to the pub. But yes, there is also this trend amongst younger people either not to drink or to drink less, but they're also having less sex and all sorts of other things that it's a sort of more risk-averse youth that we're dealing with. So I think that is a trend. On the other hand, there has also been a long-term trend of abstention in Ireland. So I think it's something like a quarter of people in Ireland don't drink at all. So the rest of them are keeping up a good strike rate. And they're not the Latvians, they're not the Austrians in terms of putting it away, but they're still, doing a pretty good job of drinking. But clearly the sort of environment in which the Irish drinker has to face now is a much more hostile one.
And Chris, unless you've got any more on this, I want to turn to a story that has become a part of your beat here, I think it's fair to say, over recent months, which is the huge scandal before the election, which has now completely disappeared. So before the election, people will remember that there were these series of betting scandals involving people in and around the Prime Minister who were betting on the date of the election. It affected a couple of prospective candidates, or certainly it affected some higher-ups within the Tory party, also some close protection officers and so on. And you've been saying for some time that this was probably going to go nowhere as soon as Labour got into power. That seems to be the case, doesn't it? Do you want to tell us about some updates on this huge scandal, which has now completely disappeared from view?
Yes, indeed. So as predicted, the Met Police have come out with a statement saying there will be no prosecutions about the political betting so-called scandal, and that they haven't found anyone to prosecute under the misconduct in public office. Yeah, that was the allegation, which actually is slightly surprising because I thought if there was going to be any prosecutions at all, it would be actually the Met Police officers who were putting money on the date of the election. So these would be the guys, presumably, who were standing outside number 10 Downing Street, and they got wind of when the election was going to be called, and apparently one or two of them at least put bets on. That struck me as quite possibly misconduct in public office. So if anyone was going to have the book thrown at me, it would be them. Now, sceptical people might say, well, the Met Police just look after their own. Possibly so, or possibly there wasn't much of a crime, if any, in the first place. So they have dropped everything, and they're saying, well, we're going to hand it over to the Gambling Commission now. If they want to make some prosecutions, they can do. I'm not even sure the Gambling Commission can make prosecutions. I'm not quite sure that the legal status is there, but I'm prepared to double down on my bet and say that nothing will come of that either.
And Rob, what have you made of all this?
Well, I mean, some of it was a bit ludicrous anyway, like people betting 6 months beforehand that there would be an election in the first half of the year, I think, or before the end of July, and getting payouts on that kind of thing.
Well, they wouldn't do because it was in July, wasn't it, the election?
No. I mean, I'm saying that there was some senior Scottish Tory put a bet on, which obviously did pay out, that an election would be called in the first half of the year or something, and he put it on months.
It's like Alistair Jack.
But he put it on months ago. It was just one of these kind of really shallow bits of sleazemongering, which really suited the Labour Party at the time because it brought back echoes Partygate and corruption and all that sort of stuff, which, again, suited the general we're sick of the Tories vibe during the election campaign. But it was a bit dubious whether anything had done anything wrong other than by looking a bit stupid, really, and not sticking, you know, doing things that were not very PR clever. But in terms of, you know, serious, this is not like sort of insider trading where like there's billions involved. This is people sticking 100 quid on an election date, and it doesn't seem to have cost the rest of society anything at all. So I think it's a storm in the teacup, rather, really.
Well, yeah, it was, but it was blown out of all proportion. And people have said to me, well, what does it matter? The Tories are going to lose anyway. Look, I'm not saying that the political betting scandal changed the course of election. It probably didn't even have an effect on the number of seats won as well. But, yeah, electoral interference is electoral interference, no matter what the outcome is. And I see this as being election interference. And the only possible justification you can have for going public in this way, in this unprecedented way, is if there's been some serious criminal misdoing. And there, it doesn't look like there has been. I don't think there ever was. So I go back to what I said back in June, which is that, you know, the scandal here is how this stuff got out into the public domain in an extremely sensitive time. And I think the Gambling Commission has questions to answer. And I predicted back then that there would never be a leak inquiry or anything like that. And there hasn't been. There's been no suggestion of it, but there should be.
And do we think the Labour Party started to get bitten by its own kind of sanctimony in a lot of these never-ending scandals? There has been the stuff in recent weeks about them appointing, you know, various Labour apparatchiks to the jobs of senior civil servants. There's this whole scandal about Lord Ali and his pass to Number 10 Downing Street. There's the fact that never gets talked about, which is that Sue Gray's son is now a Labour MP and Lord Ali also donated specifically to his campaign. Which is not to say that any of this is criminal, let alone really that much of a big deal. But do you think Keir Starmer's kind of, I am Mr. Rules, Mr. Standing Up Straight on all of these issues, is starting to unravel in the face of the grubby business of Westminster politics?
Yeah, it's been kind of hilarious how quickly it's become sleazy. I thought they would manage to keep it respectable for a while longer. I mean, quite honestly, just the fact that Sue Gray is there in such a high position of power, having written the report that damn Boris Johnson is sleazy enough. I don't think people talk about how ridiculous that situation was and how livid people would be if the boot was on the other foot, you know, and Labour, the civil servant had kind of tried to finish off a Labour prime minister and got a job with the Tories. I don't think Labour are going to be much different to the Tories, and never did think they were going to be. And it's kind of surprising how sleazy it's got so early, but history tells you that parties don't tend to clean up their act as time goes on. Do you know what I mean? It tends to get worse. So we could be in for an entertaining 5 years.
Well, I mean, every political party has its sort of hangers on, and I think that there'll be plenty of these, you know, being elevated to the Lords, people from NGOs being appointed to head quangos. But actually, the only thing that the Conservatives ever did wrong in this regard is that they kept appointing people from the left to run quangos and things like that, rather than because they didn't want to be seen to be unfair. And the Labour Party obviously has absolutely no conscience on that side of things. So they're quite happy to just stick their people into all these posts or have, you know, donors become senior civil servants, which is just astonishing, really. They have, yes, no qualms about it whatsoever. That is, unfortunately, the business of government these days, and we should call all sides out whenever they do it, because it is sleazy.
Absolutely. I mean, it seems like they don't think it's a problem because it's the right kind of people doing it now. So therefore, all other ethical issues should be put to one side. Rob, we're fast running out of time. I'm not sure if you've been on the show since we introduced this new final section, but I'm going to do it anyway, which is, if you had to have one ban, what would it be? If you were a dictator for the day, if there was just one thing that irks you that irritates you on a daily basis?
Well, I was in London. I had the misfortune of having to travel back from London 10 days ago. And
is this when you kicked the train in anger?
No. That was early. That was merely travelling in Scotland, so I don't know. Wonder I was angry. And there was a young woman, probably a student age, sitting in the seat across the aisle from me, who spent the entire trip from Berwick-upon-Tweed up to Edinburgh, an hour and a half, or whatever it is. No, it must have been Newcastle to Edinburgh, an hour and a half of having a telephone call with the speakerphone on because she was too lazy to put it to her ear. So I would have those people dragged out in the street. Or, a ban might be acceptable, but I think some traditional old punishments of the stocks some other humiliation might be in order for that.
Did you ever consider confronting about this? Because some people do now.
Well, I did consider it.
People play music. Some brave souls go up and say, sorry, can you put some headphones on?
I did consider it, but I thought I might lose my rag, actually, so I just got on with it. And at the time, I was trying to concentrate on something as well. And when you can hear her side of the conversation and a tinny version of the other side of the conversation, it's extremely distracting. So, yes, that's one habit I would ban quite happily.
A very popular choice, I'm sure. Rob, Chris, thank you both very much.
Cheers.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.